We'd like to invite members of the Harvest Fair Committee to come forward and light the chalice as I share the words of our call to worship. This is a place of grace. This is a place of losing and finding our way upon the winding road, of meeting and parting, of stumbling and starting over. Every journey is sacred, and even our stumbling steps do not lead backward. Welcome, one and all, to this place of grace. Welcome to this time of worship. Love is the spirit of this church, and service its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek truth and love, and to help one another.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So today Tracy's going to be talking about forgiveness as we move on to our religious education programs. And I want to start by asking, has there ever been a time when you found it really hard to forgive someone? Probably most of you can think of a time, and I even see some hands up. So today I'm going to tell you a story. It's a very old folktale story about someone named Old Joe. Old Joe lived way out in the countryside, all by himself. His best friend was his closest neighbor. It seemed that they had grown old together. Now that their spouses had moved up, passed on, and their children were raised and living lives of their own, all they had left were their own farms and each other. But for the first time in their long friendship, they'd had a serious disagreement. It was a silly argument over a stray calf that neither one of them really needed. The calf was found on the neighbor's land, and he claimed it as his own. Old Joe said, "No, no, now that calf has the same markings as one of my cows, and I say it belongs to me." Well, they were both very stubborn men, and neither would give in. And rather than discuss it or work it out, they just stopped talking to each other and stomped off to their respective doors and slammed them shut. 2 weeks went by, and neither a word, they hadn't spoken to each other at all. Come Saturday morning, Old Joe heard a knock on the front door. He wasn't expecting anyone and was surprised to find a young man who called himself a traveling carpenter. He had a wooden toolbox at his feet, and there was kindness in his eyes. "I'm looking for work," he explained. "I'm good with my hands, and if you have a project or two, I'd like to help you out." Old Joe replied, "Well, as a matter of fact, I do have a job for you. See that house over yonder? That's my neighbor's house. And you see that creek running along our property line? That creek wasn't there last week. He did that to spite me. He hitched a plow to his tractor, dug the creek bed from the upper pond right down the property line. Then he flooded it. Now we got this creek to separate us. I'm so darn mad at him. I've got some lumber in my barn, boards, posts, everything you'll need to build me a fence, a 10-foot-tall fence, all along that creek. Then I won't have to see his place no more. That'll teach him." The carpenter smiled and said, "I'll do a good job for you." The old man had to go to town for supplies, so he hitched up his wagon and left for the day. The young carpenter carried the lumber from the barn to the creekside and started to work. He worked hard and he worked fast. He measured and sawed and nailed those boards into place all day long without stopping for lunch. With the setting of the sun, he started to put his tools away. He had finished his project. Old Joe pulled up, his wagon full of the supplies. When he saw what the carpenter had built, he couldn't speak. It wasn't a fence. Instead, a beautiful footbridge with handrails and all reached from one side of the creek to the other. Just then, Old Joe's neighbor crossed the bridge, his hand stuck out, and said, "I'm right sorry about our misunderstanding, Joe. The calf is yours. I just want us to go on being good friends." "You keep the calf," said old Joe. "I want us to be friends, too. The bridge was this young fellow's idea, and I'm glad he did it." The carpenter hoisted his toolbox onto his shoulder and started to leave. "Wait," said Joe. "You're a good man. My neighbor and I can keep you busy for weeks." The carpenter smiled and said, "I'd like to stay, but I can't. I have more bridges to build." And he walked on down the road, whistling a happy tune as he went. Now, I'd like you all to just take a second, close your eyes, and see someone that has hurt you, that you've had a hard time forgiving. Perhaps it's over something major, perhaps it's over something minor, like a cow, that just has gotten in the way. And I'd like you to see that person and you on this bridge meeting in the middle. Just consider, as you go through your week, as you meet those circumstances, as you think about people in the past, if you can see yourselves on the bridge rather than on the other side of the creek. All right, thank you. And at this point, we're going to carry the lantern to Ari, and I'm wondering if Luke Dross would help carry the lantern.
Among the gifts we share is our capacity as a community to make change in the world. Half of all of our non-pledge contributions during the month of October will go to the Habitat for Humanity of North Central Massachusetts. Next Sunday, we have the honor of welcoming their director, Carolyn Reed, to be with us in the service. And there's more information on the insert that you were given this morning. This is the time for the sharing of our gifts.
Thank you.
The reading is entitled Hall of Records. It's by the Reverend Teresa Inez Soto. In the administrative department of my heart, which is down the hall from feelings major, I wrote down the time you offended me. The clerk, my own silent witness, filled out the forms in triplicate. We wrote your name. We added the hurt to the memory banks, photocopied and indexed. We shook our heads at the bitter sharpness of the hurt. We announced it over the loudspeaker so no cell, no heartbeat, and no breath would ever overlook the danger you present or the pain that you can bring. And then we were proud of our work. We stood quiet in the halls of everything, hands in our pockets, and waited. But human still, we both remain. And while we were recording in the most accurate way possible, you grew some more and changed some more, and so did I. Believing the best yet to come, I was surprised to see that no recording of a single moment could reflect accurately on who you are right now in this moment. Some people say that forgiveness, destruction of the record, is for my own benefit. Perhaps. But perhaps I don't need you to apply to the Department of Sorry, third floor, two doors down from the master list of everything unreasonably kind, because mistakes are a human condition. I want everything good for you and for me, and this includes the way we just, as necessary for beings of our kind, begin again. For our hymn, friends, I invite you to leave the hymnal behind the pew, in front of you, in the pocket. It's a very simple hymn. To my spoken words, you will sing a simple refrain. Mike and Sung Hee and the choir will help us with that, sing it through a couple of times so we can get a little familiar. That phrase will repeat after each of my spoken phrases. Your words are simply these. We forgive ourselves and each other. We begin again in love. For remaining silent when a single voice would have made a difference. For each time that our fears have made us rigid and inaccessible. We forgive ourselves and each other. We begin again in love. For each time we have struck out in anger without just cause. for each time that our greed has blinded us to the needs of others.
We forgive ourselves and each other.
For the selfishness that set us apart and alone.
We forgive ourselves and each other. We begin again in
love. For falling short of the admonitions of the Spirit.
We forgive ourselves and each other. We begin again in love.
For losing sight of our unity. For those and for so many acts, both evident and subtle, which have fueled the illusion of separateness.
We forgive ourselves and each other. We begin again in love.
I do not ask for forgiveness. It seems to me that my business is genuine confession of having hurt or otherwise damaged another. The forgiveness will come when and if the other person is able to accept my confession. It is not my place to presume they are ready for that. I do not ask forgiveness. I accept it when it is offered. Those words are from a friend and colleague of mine, Ken Collier. It's just a brief bit from a book he's been writing explaining why he's given up on forgiveness. And I get it. There are no guarantees that the person I've harmed will be willing or ready or able or even want to say yes when asked, "Will you forgive me?" How could I, how dare I, risk inflicting further harm? In the discipline of forgiveness, the Reverend Liz Lerner McClay, who is both Unitarian Universalist and Jewish, writes that within Judaism, the onus to invoke forgiveness is on the wrongdoer, not on the wronged. The steps drawn from Jewish tradition are, she says, non-negotiable. It is up to the person who did the injury to own up and admit what they did, apologize and ask for forgiveness, offer to make it up to the injured person however they can and however the injured person chooses. The onus to invoke forgiveness is on the wrongdoer and not the wronged. I remember too many times in these last years when I've heard a journalist ask members of an African American family or any family of color who have just lost a loved one to violence, they ask, "Do you forgive this person for killing your child, your husband? Do you forgive them for the death of your sister, your father?" I cannot stop remembering when that question was asked over and over to the families who lost loved ones in the shootings in Mother Emmanuel AME Church. Do you remember Mother Emmanuel? 9 people shot and killed during a Bible study, including the pastor, Clementa Pinckney. Whenever I saw or heard those families ask that question, they responded simply, "Yes," they said. "Yes, we forgive the person who did this." But when asked in that way, under such circumstances, the question, "Do you forgive?" is not about forgiveness. It is an effort to reassure the privileged that the status quo is safe. The onus to invoke forgiveness is on the wrongdoer, not on the wronged. And until it is invoked, it cannot be given, even when the person wronged finds it inside themselves to forgive, finds that forgiveness helps them live and helps them move on. The onus to invoke forgiveness is on the wrongdoer. Now, though my friend Ken gave up on asking for forgiveness, he has not given up on forgiveness itself being possible between and among us humans, and I've not given up either. I believe forgiveness is possible because I am universalist. Though it can be a long and slow and arduous thing, it is in every one of us to change, and the heart of universalism is change. As Teresa Soto wrote in the Hall of Records, "Human we remain. You grew some more and changed some more, and so did I. Believing the best yet to come, no recording of a single moment could reflect accurately on who you are right now. Mistakes are a human condition. I want everything good for you and for me, and this includes the way we, just as necessary for beings of our kind, begin again." I believe forgiveness is possible because I am Unitarian. Though it is sometimes buried under hatred, under fear, I believe that people are essentially good, and goodness is at the heart of Unitarianism. I rely on human goodness and the hundreds of ways we find to show it and share it. When it comes to asking, "Will you forgive me?" Margaret Wheatley, in her poem, "Turning to One Another," reminds us this. "Remember," she says, "you don't fear people whose story you know. Real listening always brings people closer together. Trust that meaningful conversations can change your world. Rely on human goodness." So with all this talk of forgiveness and change and goodness, I ask you, please don't misunderstand what I'm saying as a bad case of naivete. I know we human beings do horrible things to one another. I learned one of the most dramatic and painful lessons in this human truth during my service on a Middlesex County grand jury. Our charge was to determine whether evidence submitted by the district attorney's office in the over 500 cases we heard was sufficient to warrant indicting the individual accused in each one of them. Over the course of 3 months, I heard so many women and so very many children testify before us in person about harm done to them. Their stories challenged. Friends, you know this part, right? You've met me before. If you have, you know, hardwired to cry and haven't changed a bit. I'm fine. I welcome the company. Their stories challenged every bit, every single bit of faith I possessed about the possibility of change and the presence of goodness and the capacity to forgive. Somehow, my faith held. And it holds to this day. Despite new and different challenges, despite being stretched incredibly thin at times, it holds. I do not know what became of those I helped to indict. I do not know what became of the women and children who testified. And I don't know if that jury's actions did anything at all to make forgiveness any more possible. I just don't know. One more thought and one more story. The thought is inspired by the title of that poem by Margaret Wheatley, Turning to One Another. The heart of forgiveness is turning. Turning inward at first. The one who has done harm searches their own heart, seeking to understand the harm done and its impact. And then, perhaps, comes a turning outward, toward the one who has been harmed, and toward a world forever changed. For the person harmed, there is a turning inward to do what they can, to do what they must with the harm done. Doing what they can, doing what they must to figure out if and how forgiveness is possible. And then comes a turning outward. For the person harmed seeks to make sense of their world, made forever different. This kind of turning is at the heart of the work for justice done by South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. They put forgiveness to the test in the aftermath of apartheid. Looking back on a process he helped create and lead, Archbishop Desmond Tutu told this story. These are his words. Malusi Pumlamana was a young, enthusiastic anti-apartheid activist involved in a vital community development and health project with impoverished and demoralized rural communities. He and his wife were under strict surveillance, constantly harassed by the ubiquitous security police, and they were frequently held in detention without trial. The Archbishop goes on, I remember well a day Malusi gave the security police the slip and showed up in my office in Johannesburg. He told me that during his frequent stints in detention, when the security police routinely tortured him, he used to think, these are God's children, and yet they are behaving like animals. They need us to help them recover the humanity they have lost. Archbishop Tutu continued, during these years of suffering and inequality, each South African's humanity was still tied to that of all others, white or black, friend or enemy. Our own dignity can only be measured in the way we treat others. This was Malusi's extraordinary insight. Forgiveness is not just personally rewarding, Tutu said. It is also a political necessity. In the act of forgiveness, we are declaring our faith in the future of a relationship and in the capacity of the wrongdoer to change. We are welcoming a chance to make a new beginning because we are not infallible, because we will hurt one another by some wrong. We will always need a process of forgiveness and reconciliation to deal with those all too human breaches in relationships. They are an inescapable characteristic of the human condition. Political necessity of forgiveness is the current enduring challenge to my faith in forgiveness being possible. In the hymn we sang just before the sermon, we begin again in love. Breaches in relationship were called out here in the presence of this community. We may see ourselves in some of those words. We may remember when some of those things happened here. Breaches made of silence, of fear, anger, greed, selfishness. Times we have fallen short, lost sight, fueled the illusion of our separateness from one another. And after the calling out, we spoke words of forgiveness, first making the inward turn of forgiving ourselves, and then turning outward toward one another. As we hold each other's lives and each other's futures in our hands, may we begin again in love. So may it be. Our closing hymn, O Sing Alleluia, is adapted from Psalm 150 and from the Avena Malkeinu, a prayer said in the Jewish services held on Rosh Hashanah and on Yom Kippur. Please rise in body and spirit for this song.
Praise be to
benediction is by Tom Shade. He writes, "My friends, there is a power at work in the universe. It works through human hands, but was not made by human hands. It is a creative, sustaining, and transforming power, and we can trust that power with our lives. It will sustain us when we answer the call of love, when we act for peace and for justice, whenever we take a risk. Trust that power. We are together held by that power."